I just learned that your actual age might not be the same as your biological age, meaning, depending on lifestyle habits, someone can either accelerate or decelerate the aging process. But just where do you stack up? That's where True Diagnostic comes in. With their True Age test, you can discover your biological age, plus get insights into things like your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, and even early mortality. I just completed my True Age test, and I'm super excited to see what it reveals about my health. Right now, my listeners can get 20% off their entire order at TrueDiagnostic.com by using the code Harris at checkout. That's True Diagnostic, TrueDiagnostic.com. Just use the code HARRIS to save 20%. Plus, if you subscribe, you'll get an additional 20% off the 50% discount. Discover your true age today. If you're like me, you want to keep your personal information safe. There are many VPN companies out there to help you do this, but I'm using NordVPN, especially with their online layer and double layer VPN options, as well as their dark web monitor, which scans the dark web to see if your information is compromised in places you wouldn't normally look. NordVPN aims to make the internet a better place for everyone. Free the internet from the online threats, censorship, and surveillance whilst giving users the ability to access content which isn't available in their region. The NordVPN threat protection feature protects you from viruses, malicious malware, and phishing sites. With one NordVPN subscription, you can use this service on up to 10 devices. To get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/matter, matter, which will also give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. The link is in the podcast episode description box. We are live now on the Conversations That Matter podcast. I'm your host, John Harris. I hope everyone's doing well out there. It is a gloomy day in New York, but progressively going towards spring, which after a long winter is definitely refreshing. So I was just outside doing some work, and as I was doing some work, getting rid of leaves and salt and all the rest that comes with winter, the Amazon truck came, Amazon truck doesn't come to my house very often. I seldom order things on Amazon, but my book is using Amazon printers, and this is what it looks like. So I got my first author's copies of Against the Waves, Christian Order in a Liberal Age. Wanted everyone to be aware of that, and I have a lot of copies. So if you are interested in this book, I'll do more content and let people know a little more what's in it as we go. But you can go to johnharrispodcast.com. You can go to Amazon.com. You can order it there. It is on Kindle, and it should be on Audible if it's not now by the end of the week. So just want to give everyone an update on that. Now, that being said, we have a very special guest today and a topic that I've been really looking forward to, because abortion needs to be completely ended, abolished, made illegal. And we've had trouble the last few years getting to this point, even with Republicans in certain very deep red states running everything. They have the governor, they have the legislature, they have the court in their states, and they just can't seem to get past this point, even after the Dobbs decision. So my interest is in doing what we're about to do is really primarily to look at the best strategic ways that you, as a faithful Christian who wants to also see the end of abortion, how can you take the limited resources you have and put them to good use if the Lord's called you to this kind of thing. And with me to discuss this is a very special guest. We have Bradley Pierce for the first time on the podcast. Bradley Pierce is a lawyer who you can find out more about at FAA.life, the Foundation to Abolish Abortion. He is the producer of a documentary series called Abortion Free, which you can go watch there. And Bradley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John. It's great to be with you.
My pleasure. Well, give us a little bit more about what you do. Obviously, you're a lawyer and you're trying to fight abortion. How are you doing that exactly?
Yeah, well, the main thing that we do at the Foundation to Abolish Abortion is we draft equal protection legislation. So this session, Right now, there's a lot of abolition, equal protection bills filed around the country. We've been involved with writing almost all of those. And so that's what we've been doing, you know, for a number of years now. And so we get involved with drafting those, get involved working with legislators, helping grassroots organizations that support those, you know, doing educational things as well, and, you know, presentations at conferences, and just trying to get the message out there of how we believe God would have us to address this issue of abortion, and kind of like you're talking about, what is our individual duties, and really speaking to Christians, and also, you know, especially to pastors, you know, how can pastors be properly equipping the saints for the work of ministry on this issue?
Could you give us a lay of the land? Because I keep seeing polls that claim that the majority of Americans, especially Gen Z, are very much pro-choice or pro-abortion, and that this is a growing hill to climb on a national level. But there are states that are very deep red, where the people, like Oklahoma, Idaho, where the people are very against abortion. At least they say they're pro-life. Everyone elected says they're pro-life in these Republican majorities. So it seems to me that there's some areas, especially post-Dobbs decision, where we can work. We have some latitude, but it doesn't seem like things are progressing as fast as one would expect, especially as fast as the left would say things are. I mean, they act like, you know, what is it, 38 states or something have already banned or limited abortion. They paint this very scary picture to their base, right, who cares very much about making sure abortion is accessible. So give us a lay of the land. Where are we really at in the United States?
Yeah, you know, I think one way, can address it in a number of different ways, but I think one way is to kind of compare this to the issue of slavery. Again, not just because we're abolitionists, but because there are a lot of overlaps. One way of viewing this is that, you know, after the Civil War, we had slavery abolished in every state under the 13th Amendment when that was passed, officially abolishing it there. You know, before that, we had, let's say, 1850, where we had lots of northern states that had abolished slavery, but, you know, southern states obviously had not. But then go back to 1750, when not a single state had abolished slavery. And that's where we are today when it comes to the issue of abortion. Not to say that it's necessarily going to be, you know, 110, 120 years from now before we actually abolish abortion, you know, hopefully it's much sooner. But we still have a long road ahead of us. It's still legal in every state for mothers to abort their children. And so even in the red states, pro-life states that have passed, you know, what I'd call kind of third-party bans on abortion, banning third parties from assisting with that, you know, which ends up shutting down the clinics, it's not illegal there. It's explicitly written into the bills. This does not apply to the mother in all the pro-life bills. So that way, because of that, moms are still able to order the pills, possess the pills, take the pills, and abort their children in those states, in addition to the abortion travel, you know, going to other states. And so we still have a long way to go. There's no state that has actually abolished abortion. You know, when you do it like that, it's kind of like saying slavery is illegal for everyone except for the slave owner. It's like, well, then we have not abolished slavery there. So there's still a lot of work to do. You know, we do see, you know, it's kind of the, you know, there's polls go different ways as far as where people in the country are. Obviously, the majority of folks, I would say the majority of folks really just don't care. You know, there's just a lot of apathy on both sides. But since the Dobbs decision overturned Roe versus Wade, we have seen a greater action from the pro-abortion side and making a number of gains around the country.
Well, yeah, tell me about that. I mean, what gains has the pro-abortion side made? I mean, I know there's been some bills that they've defeated, that, like in Ohio, for example, but what do you see as gains?
Yeah, well, they've defeated a ballot initiative right after Dobbs in Kansas that would have, you know, provided some more protections for preborn children. But since then, they've actually tried many of their own ballot initiatives to actually enshrine abortion as a constitutional right in many states. And in most of those where they've tried, they've actually been passed. So, for example, Ohio, you mentioned there, they passed a ballot initiative basically enshrining abortion as a fundamental right. And a number of other states where that's happened. Some of those have gotten defeated, like in Florida, but even in the state like Missouri, if, you know, if a red state, they were able to pass a ballot initiative like that. So I think it's because, you know, after Roe overturned, or after Dobbs overturned Roe, I think a lot of the pro-life movement, your average pro-life voter, that's what they had been fighting for so long, is overturning Roe. And once that was accomplished, I think a lot of people either totally went to sleep on the issue or just really moved it to the back burner, whereas the opposite happened on the pro-abortion side. It became very much a front issue. And so I think that's why we have seen, and we are seeing right now, you know, the pro-abortion side making those kind of political gains.
This is an interesting dynamic for me because it feels so surreal. I remember for years, defeating Roe v. Wade was the goal. And that was pretty much the only goal, it seemed like, for the pro-life movement. And it seemed unreachable. Like, we would never get there. I was pretty skeptical that, especially right, Donald Trump would get us there. But here we are. And the Dobbs decision is not a perfect decision, but it did, I think, give us probably more latitude than we had before to work on the state level. And after, you know, that happened, it's like there's no plan, really. I shouldn't say no plan. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but that is how it feels to me. Like, like now we're lost in the pro-life or anti-abortion movement. And I don't really know why that is exactly. Like, I'm still very much interested in getting this taken care of and making sure that it's illegal to kill one's child. But I see what you're talking about. People are not as motivated on this as they were before. I don't know if other issues have overshadowed that
right,
it's closer to home in a tangible way for them. But, you know, every time you see, or, you know, one of those videos or signs, or, you know, just that, those jolting reminders that this is a child that is being killed, I mean, it just cuts right to the heart of, like, man, this is still a huge, huge, huge issue, something we should care about as believers. So how do you cut past that? How do you get to, especially legislators who claim to be Christians in red states that seem to vote against abolishing abortion?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of them that I think a lot of people really do think that the issue is solved in their states, right? Because even in a lot of these Republican states, you know, the clinics, when they were here, had to report the number of abortions that they were performing and to the health department. And so the health department still collects those. And so, you know, on paper, if you actually go look at the health department reports, yeah, you're going to see in a lot of these states, you know, high numbers, like, for example, here in Texas, you know, 55 to 60,000 abortions a year. And it's the same way in a lot of other, you know, or pretty much all the other states. And then after Dobbs, you know, then we had a trigger bill, right, that made it illegal for the clinics to operate. And then you see the number dropping, you know, from 55, 60,000 down to, you know, 100 or even 50, or, you know, and which are really mostly just kind of what they call abortions, but are mostly kind of a life of the mother situations. And you think, oh, well, hey, great. We've effectively abolished abortion here. You know, abortion's basically gone. Let's move on to another issue. But what that doesn't show is the number of abortions, you know, that abortions are still happening. They're just, you know, either going out of the state or they're ordering the pills in the state, and none of that ends up getting reported in the state. So you get this, you know, facade of having, you know, that, oh, we've dramatically lowered the numbers, when it's like, actually there's more abortions now in the U.S. than there were even 10 years ago. And even in the 14 states that many people consider to be abortion free, there's still as many. In some states, it's only a slight decrease. In some states, it's basically the same. In some states, it's even an increase since before the Dobbs case. And a lot of people don't realize that. So a lot of our work right now is not just educating people, yes, here's the biblical way to abolish abortion, you know, we believe in equal protection, that's what the Constitution requires, et cetera, but making people aware of that, hey, this is still a problem in the first place, because a lot of people think that it's not.
And that could be an inhibitor. If people think that this is a done deal in their state, they're not going to put resources towards fighting it anymore, because right, they think the battle's done. There's other issues. But I want to explore that a little, because I have heard this so often that the number of abortions have gone up or remained the same. And is this just because technology has changed and people are able to get in-home medications or abortifacients? I don't know if there's other ways they're accomplishing abortions in later stages, but they're able to get these things and kind of, you know, do it yourself abortions, or what is it? Because it honestly doesn't make sense to me either that if there's no Planned Parenthoods in your state, somehow the numbers of abortions remain the same. That I can't wrap my head around that. So maybe if you could walk us through how that's possible.
I think the main way that it's happening is, so when Dobbs overturned Roe, then it basically ran Planned Parenthood ultimately out of 14 states currently today, that are being called abortion free. So obviously it didn't really deal with the demand, right? People were still wanted abortion. It didn't change people's hearts in that regard. And because the law said it didn't apply to mothers, it didn't change really the supply. It just changed the method. And so what we've seen is that because it kind of eliminated the clinics from these states, it actually made it much more financially viable for the pill providers, to basically create what I, no offense to Amazon, but like the Amazon.com of abortions, right? To where you can now go online and order. And so it's kind of like, even in, just think about whenever COVID was around, a lot of stores were closed, or it was really hard to get, to stores, or it was really pain. And yet consumer buying actually increased in spite of that. And so I think that's what we've seen. But where did the consumer buying go, right? It went online. And so I think that's what we're seeing with the abortion issue is that, yes, it's harder to go to a clinic now, but it's actually cheaper and easier to actually do the abortions because the market has shifted to the abortion pills online. That's driven the prices way down. And it's way easier to do that. And so instead of going and getting a $600-$700 clinic abortion, you can now go get a $150 pill abortion.
That makes a lot of sense. I was just in Kentucky last week, and I know they have a bill to abolish abortion that's going through. And the church that I was speaking at, a lot of the members there are very active on this front and trying to get Christian leaders and political Republican leaders to support this bill. And anyway, the thing I was talking to them about a little bit, and I'd love to pick your brain on this, is, if it's, as you say, it's like the Amazon.com abortion pill coming in, this becomes an interstate commerce issue, right? Like this is where the federal government would have to get involved. The only thing a state government could effectively do in that case, I suppose, would be you can't kill a 2-year-old in your house, right? So you can't kill the child in the womb. So they can put that on the books, but it was very difficult, I would think, to enforce that because it is, 2-year-old has a social security card. People ask questions, especially at an early stage in a pregnancy. There's really going to be no evidence. There's going to be no one's going to know possibly that this even happened. It is so easy to conceal. So, what is the hope with a bill like that in your mind? Like, what would the government be able to do that they can't do right now?
Yeah, well, obviously the actual shipment of the pills is an interstate commerce issue, but ultimately the act of homicide is very, very much a state issue and happening within the states. And so we do believe that state homicide laws need to apply to people from the moment of fertilization. And there's some states where they already do, but then they have written in even the homicide law does not apply to the mother with regard to her own unborn child. So we need to remove those exceptions so that way the law, everyone's equally subject to the law and then everyone's equally protected by the law. That's what we want. Certainly it's going to be more difficult to actually enforce those, but kind of backing up, in some ways the point of the law is not, is not to find and enforce it or to find the criminals and penalize them. The primary point of the law, or the first function of the law is to educate. This is, basically as the Bible says, to tutor. This is the value of life. This is how much we value life. We value these lives equally with these lives. And the penalty is strict because of how much we value life. But then if people don't agree with that, then the law is to restrain evil, right? It's to deter people from committing those crimes. Yeah, there's lots of people that would commit crimes every day if we didn't have penalties in those laws. Those penalties serve the purpose of restraining them, which is for their good, but of course is for the good of the potential victims. And then finally, the law is there to provide justice. Yeah, if people will not be taught, they will not be deterred, they go through with it, okay, now there needs to be justice provided, which then ultimately teaches and deters as well when justice is carried out. And so that's certainly more difficult in this context, but it's not really not that difficult in a lot of situations. I was actually talking to someone just the other day, actually a police officer, who in the course of investigating a crime came across text messages between the suspect that he was investigating and his girlfriend, where his girlfriend indicates, "Hey, I'm pregnant. You know, what are you going to do?" And he's like, "Well, I'm going to give you money for the abortion. Okay, let's order the pills." And they're kind of going back and forth in these text messages, like, "All right, ordering the pills. All right, you know, did you get the money?" "Yes, I got the money." "All right, did you do it?" Like, I mean, today, in some ways today, it's almost easier to enforce because of how much evidence people are constantly shedding, as we lawyers would say, like constantly shedding evidence because of how much we're texting and videoing ourselves and pictures and everything today. So in some ways, it's actually easier to enforce than ever. And even the ordering of the pills, right? There's receipts for that and things for that. And so, yes. And so it'll certainly be more difficult than investigating homicides of born people, but certainly not impossible.
There's some questions coming in and I have a lot of questions too, but I want to get to some of these. Javier Oliva says, "If states can prohibit the shipping of a particular gun magazine, why can't it prohibit abortion drugs?" That's a good question, because in New York, we had something a few years ago called the SAFE Act, and we were limited in all kinds of ways. But one of the ways that particular law limited us was through the size of the magazine. Essentially, sports stores could not carry a magazine that held over 7 bullets. And so I don't know exactly how legally that all worked out, but no one was shipping any of this stuff. And if you go on like Cabela's to try to order that, it's not coming to New York. So why can't that same thing apply to abortion pills?
It kind of does in a couple of different ways. So first of all, you know, there's many states that have passed what they call drug-inducing abortion pill bans or chemical abortion pill bans that do prohibit shipping pills in and or manufacturing pills or distributing pills within the state. And, the primary issue with those is that even all of those also say this does not apply to the mother. And so it's one of those, it's like if you had a ban, it's illegal to possess, a magazine over 5, but this doesn't apply to gun owners. It's like, wait a second. I mean, you know what I'm saying? So that hurts it from being effective. And then secondly, there actually is a federal law that prohibits the interstate, shipping in the mails of abortion drugs. There's actually a federal law that's been on the books for about 100 years, I believe. And it's called the Comstock Act. It prohibits, distributing some other materials as well, but it's not being enforced today. So the Biden administration's did this huge memo saying why they weren't going to enforce it. The Trump administration so far has not made any indications that they're going to enforce that as well. Even if they did, there's certainly plenty of ways around it, shipping or traveling in other ways. But at least that would make it more difficult. But even that's not being enforced today.
So I've never heard this, I don't think, or if I forgot it, if I've heard it. There's a law on the books as it stands right now to prohibit abortifacients from being shipped across state lines in this country.
That's right. Yep.
So this is kind of like the border situation. We have the laws, but just no one's actually doing anything about them.
That's a good way of describing it. You know, it is somewhat a, I mean, it wouldn't solve the core issue, which is that homicide is legal.
Right.
You know, and
right.
ultimately it's kind of a gun control issue, right? Or a drug war kind of issue. You can make it illegal, but if you're not dealing with the actual root issue of homicide, then, you know, you're just kind of chopping it. You're not getting to the root, right? You're just kind of chopping at the branches. But should they enforce it? Should the Trump administration enforce it? Absolutely, yes. But at least so far, they haven't indicated that they are going to.
Yeah. Are there any positive things you see about the Trump administration? I know the Mexico City policy has been reinstated from what I understand. It sounds like Trump is going to allow states to have the latitude to try to sort some of these things out. But do you foresee any other help coming from them? Or do you think that anti-abortion folks in red states are pretty much on their own?
You know, I mean, certainly lots of positive things from the Trump administration on lots of other issues. But on this issue, yeah, other than some of those kind of more international policies, you know, certainly they, you know, pardoned the folks who had stood in front of abortion clinics and things like that, things that we're grateful for. But overall, you know, not helpful on this issue. And even a lot of the messaging during the campaign was, you know, counterproductive from the Trump administration. So we're hoping that people can get to him and reach him and, you know, help turn that toward equal protection, toward protecting children. You know, even on the kind of leaving states to do their thing, even that during the campaign, you know, there were a couple of issues. There was an issue in Arizona. There was an issue in Alabama, both of which, you know, he kind of said like, well, let's let states do their things. But he then kind of went out of his way to get involved in against the anti-abortion side. And so, you know, we're certainly not seeing leadership from him on this issue, and what we are seeing is unhelpful. Even recently, he issued an executive order that's not doesn't really do anything yet, other than, you know, ask for some recommendations, you know, on right. the issue of IVF, which, you know, has lots of problems. A lot of IVF processes, you know, involve actual homicide of children, and so you know, I don't know where that's ultimately going to go, but it's not a good sign.
Yeah, I think it's important you mention that, because I read it and after seeing some of the blowback online, and I thought, this does nothing. He's just saying we want to see some recommendations made. And the curious thing that I suppose that I was asking, and I know we're getting into maybe some different territory, but not really, because when you're destroying embryos, you are destroying human life. Just like in abortion, you're destroying human life. It's both murder. And one of the things that I've just been perplexed about is you have these pro-life organizations out there that have resources to be able to, file briefs on these things and set agendas and so forth. And it doesn't seem like there's much coming from them on the IVF front. They're awfully silent. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you can correct me. But you know, there are countries like Italy is probably the most well-known country that have severe regulations on IVF to try to make it as ethical as possible. Same-sex couples can't participate in it. I don't even know if you can do more than one or two eggs, because you have to implant whatever you fertilize. These kinds of things.
Right.
And I don't even see any mirror of that in our country. Like, there's no one advising the president, to my knowledge, saying, if you're going to do this, then let's put some regulations on this. What is going on with that? Why is there no moral direction from the pro-life organizations on this issue?
You know, I mean, certainly there are some, you know, and I'll give credit where credit's due. There certainly are some organizations that are speaking up and saying some good things and opposing kind of the what seems to be a rush, you know, to support IVF without any, you know, any questions at all. You know, but that said, I think what you're pointing out is that, yeah, generally speaking, you know, most of the pro-life leaders are fairly silent about it whenever, you know, destroying a life is destroying a life, whether that's 5 days old or 5 months old. You know, it's still just destruction of human life. And so it's something that we need to be talking about, especially if we're going to be consistent on this issue. But I think that's where a lot of it comes back to is, you know, quite frankly, a lot of the pro-life movement, and by pro-life movement, I'm not talking about like pregnancy help clinics and things like that that do a lot of awesome work. I'm even, you know, involved in the board of one of those. I'm talking about like the pro-life lobby, you know, the major lobbying organizations that have bills and, you know, that, you know, endorse politicians and politicians endorse them and things like that. There we've seen for a long time compromise on this issue of protecting life and really kind of letting the politicians, you know, drive things, which normally politicians are just, you know, I mean, there's some good ones out there, but a lot of them are just interested in getting reelected. And so, you know, taking a hard stand on a controversial issue is not, you know, not the first thing on their list. And so a lot of these pro-life organizations provide cover for them, you know, for acting in a cowardly way and being willing to compromise. And so we're seeing a lot of that.
I mean, it's frustrating because you can have a conversation about political reality and just say, look, this is where things are at. This is the barriers we have to contend with, which is why, you know, A, B, or C, we're not going to get our bill passed or whatever, right. But still being the moral conscience and saying this is wrong and this is right. Where we need to go. But abandoning the field just seems to me like you're asking for more abortions. You're asking for more discarded embryos. You're asking for more murder. You mentioned there are some big pro-life organizations that though are doing some good work. And I want to highlight that for people who might be wanting to give their finances, which are limited, to organizations that are actually in the fight. So, you know, what comes to mind is you think through some good organizations doing work.
Well, and I'm speaking specifically on the IVF issue, right? People that are speaking out, like there's a lady named Katie Faust, you know, speaking out very boldly on the IVF issue. You know, Lila Rose with Life Action speaking out very clearly on the IVF issue, and others. You know that, you know, we're going to have disagreements on other fronts, you know, with some of those, but at least on the IVF issue, you know, saying some good stuff.
Good, good. I want to get to some more of these questions because I keep asking my own here. But let's see here. We have another question here. What would it take? This is from Pacific Westy, I guess is the name. What would it take to get federal funding of Planned Parenthood stopped? What would be the result if we could get all federal funding stopped? I feel like you already started to go down this road a bit with this would incentivize the Amazon. I don't keep using Amazon, but the mail in abortions. But what do you think if we could actually get to that point of shutting them down permanently?
You know, I think it's something that, you know, we certainly want to see Planned Parenthood defunded. I don't want my tax dollars going there. But in some ways, it's, you know, it kind of gets back to how does God tell us to deal with this issue? Really, I think it's something that's fundamental we have to come back to. Otherwise, we're just kind of chipping away at the edges. We're not actually dealing with the core issue. And I think the way that God tells us to deal with murder is that it should be illegal. It should be a crime. And if we make it a crime, then that's going to deal with the whole funding issue and the, you know, the whole shipping of pills and all these other things better than anything else, right? If we really want to see Planned Parenthood defunded, then how about we make it illegal to murder people? That should be step one. And then, yeah, then let's go look in, you know, there's still some other way they're getting money. But step one has to be, let's make it illegal to murder people. And then we can go after that. Otherwise we're just kind of making it, you know, more sanitary, to murder people. We're making it to where, hey, well, I don't, you know, now I don't feel as guilty, or I don't feel like, you know, at least my tax dollars aren't going to that. But that's not, you know, the main problem isn't that my tax dollars are going to murder, you know, fund Planned Parenthood. The main problem is that people are murdering people. And so I think we need to keep the focus on that. I think that anything else, although I would love to see them strip that out of the budget, I think we have to keep our focus on equal protection. And I think if we do that, then these other things will happen automatically. I think if we keep the focus that life begins at fertilization, we should be providing equal protection to that life, then we'll see all these other things happen. But whenever we're willing to accept these compromises, like, oh, well, let's just make it illegal to, to murder babies after they're born, right? There's a whole big push in the federal government to pass that bill. And it's like, guys, if that's where you're like, that's our victory, then you're going to, at best, you're going to get that, but you're probably not even going to get that. But if you go all the way over here to the actual principle, right? Stick with the principle that here's when life begins and here's how we should protect it like all other life, then you're going to get these other things, right? But you have to shift the whole window this way in order to get any of it.
Yeah, Trump has been usually pretty good in the business world, especially. I mean, that's the art of the deal, right? Of like trying to go three steps past what he actually wants so that he can negotiate and get what he wants. And this is an issue that I've noticed for Republicans. They're not willing to play hardball like that. They don't want to go for an aggressive measure. And then, okay, let's say there's a, something happens in committee and it's a heartbeat bill, whatever. They go for the heartbeat bill from the beginning. They already have almost for some of them, I suppose, an admission that, you know, maybe it's not a child before that heartbeat is there. And yeah, it does strike me as it's odd that this is one issue. Maybe there's others that I haven't thought of, but where we don't play hardball, because there's other issues that we will certainly play hardball on. Immigration has been one of them. So, good thoughts there. Some other questions here. A question from Dr. Bob. Is the state-by-state approach ultimately feasible? It seems impossible in a place like California. And we were maybe talking about this before we started recording. How can the Republicans get abolition done without getting booted at the national level? So this is tactics and strategy, right? Not morality in the sense of like, he's not asking what's right and wrong, but he's saying, how do you make any gains in California? I have that same question. I'm sitting in New York right now. I don't even know what to do.
Yeah. Well, I think it has to become, could start at a lot of points with this, but let me start at this one. So I think that it has to become an issue that Republicans are consistent on. And consistent on our position and consistent with when life begins, consistent with how we treat that. So we have to start with that, and then we have to start with our demand and stop undermining all of our own arguments. That's been happening for a long time. So we have to get clear on that. And then in these states, like your own or like California, I know some folks are like, well, let's just try to get a heartbeat bill, or let's just try to get this, or let's just try to get that, or let's just try to get a Born Alive Infant Protection Act. But even those things are ultimately, they undermine our own arguments, and they actually end up setting us back and delaying things, because there's a lot of states, like I just mentioned earlier, there's a lot of states that have passed heartbeat bills, Born Alive Infant Protection Acts, chemical abortion, they've passed all these things, and the abortions are still happening there. Our goal is not to pass a bill. Our goal is not to pass a piece of legislation. Our goal is to establish justice, as God's required, and to protect children, to provide equal protection, right? That's what our goal is. And so, the goal isn't to just, give people, better ratings on their pro-life, organization, voting, you get an A+ or whatever for passing a bill that ultimately did nothing. And so I know folks in, like New York and California may say, boy, I would give anything even to just have a heartbeat bill. But go look around at the states that actually have heartbeat bills, and you'll see they're not actually doing anything other than they're making people think that abortion has been taken care of, but when it actually hasn't. And the other thing that they do is they make people look like they're pro-life and get the pro-life votes without actually doing anything to actually protect children.
Is it possible, though, you know more at this than I do, though, that like a heartbeat bill, though, would protect some of the children at later stages where, I don't know, maybe people, mothers are still bold enough to do some kind of an at-home abortion. I mean, I don't want to get vivid here, but, using more than just abortifacients.
Right.
because if they can't go into a clinic and get that done, that seems like a strong disincentive from having the abortion. They'd either have to travel to another state that allows it, I suppose, or do it at home. And at those later stages, that is a severe health, or, you know, that's a that is a risk to a mother's life when you got people essentially operating that, you know, without medical facilities and so forth. So, you know, correct me if I'm wrong there. It would seem to me though that that might, would save at least a few lives.
It would seem so, and perhaps there are a small number that are saved, but actually then, you know, as far as like individual, yeah, there's certainly cases out there where people say, oh, I didn't go through with it because of this. But as far as the actual data, it shows that it overall, it actually doesn't save lives. And I think what's happening is that, so, you know, a heartbeat bill is basically a 6-week abortion ban. But then even the heartbeat bill says this doesn't apply to the mother. That it's still a, you know, it's still up to 40 weeks for the mother. So these abortion pills that you order, they actually, you know, they come with, you know, instructions, and they say they can be used up to 13 weeks. And there's even people that are going, you can even go like into, you know, Reddit chat rooms, and there's people there like, well, my baby's bigger than this. And they're like, oh, well, you can just double up. And so there are a lot of people that are still that are doing that. And, you know, and we're seeing that, you know, not just people talking about, but actually people like, you know, posting pictures of it. And it's pretty horrific. So it's still happening. The heartbeat bills, you know, has, you know, may you know, impact a few people, but overall has very, very little effect. Certainly not the effect that people are led to believe it has.
It sounds to me like what's happening is people are responding to these limitations by actually being more on top of it. You know, if it's legal for the first two trimesters or something, you have an opportunity and you can think about it. Maybe that actually gives you more opportunity to think through. Right. Maybe you should save the child's life. But if there is a limitation at a certain stage, then you are incentivized, if you're going to do an abortion, to do it early. That's what it sounds like to me.
I think so. I think there's definitely that. And I think it actually ends up resulting in more abortions. Again, for some people, I've sometimes described a heartbeat bill as a hurry up and get your abortion, you know, bill, that does say, hey, you should actually act more quickly and rush into this decision even faster. So I think we certainly see that as an effect as well.
Yeah, I hadn't really noodled on that a whole lot, that would be the impact. Because, you know, I thought, well, if a mother can't get to the facilities to get an abortion in a, you know, no abortion safe, but, you know, in a way that's not as threatening to her life, then she's more likely to keep the baby. I mean, that's how I've kind of thought, like, well, but I can't get myself completely into the mind of these people. And if anything experience has taught me, they think differently. It's just going to these clinics and seeing some of the people that come in who are brazen. And I don't know if you've seen that more lately, but it seems to me, comparing what I see now at abortion clinics to what I saw years ago, there is much more of a hardenedness about it. Like, they don't care. Like, it's murder. That's fine. How do you even reason with someone like that whose conscience is that seared? You really can't.
Right.
And if that's where we're going, then it's going to take a lot of power and law to do something about that. All right. So we have some more questions here. Let's see. We have conceptual clarity. What can we do to get pastors to stand up against the state referenda pushed by the pro-abortion side and vigorously oppose them and preach against them? So not a political question as much, but what about pastors how do you see them being involved in this fight in a better way?
Yeah, well, I think pastors, you know, I guess as far as how to get them there, hopefully we can figure that out. But as far as what they should be doing, you know, I think pastors need to go study the God's word. Okay. And because I remember when, you know, I've always been grew up pro-life, you know, my parents voted pro-life. We were Republicans. Life begins at conception. I know that. I was always against abortion. But it wasn't until I actually started getting involved with this, and I even started speaking, about abolition and things like that. And someone invited me to speak at a conference about the issue in general. And I thought, you know what? I really need to do a talk about what does the Bible say about when life begins, and then look at the science and all that as well. But start with the Bible. You know, does the Bible say anything about it, or is it just kind of these vague, like before I knew you, before you were, born, I knew you, or you knit you together in your mother's womb? Is it just kind of vague statements, or does it actually clear, like, no, life begins at fertilization? Is that even in the Bible, or are we just kind of being, is the Bible just kind of vague? Or is abortion mentioned in the Bible, or even how we're to deal with it, or how we're to abolish it or make it illegal for everyone? Is that in the Bible? And the more I looked, the more I saw, it's very clear. It's very clear. And this would be a much more longer conversation, but it's very clear when life begins at fertilization. There's so many things in the Bible to make that clear. Just one of them, for example, is that, the number one word, or one of the top words used for children throughout the Bible is the word seed. And when is a seed a seed? It's whenever, literally, go study plants, botany, and it's, when a seed becomes a seed, when the sperm from one plant and the ovum from another plant come together, that's when you have a seed. And so that's when the life begins of the new plant. Well, God uses that exact same terminology to describe children, that they are seed. And anyways, many, many other examples in scripture that just make it clear when life begins, clear how we're to deal with it. Exodus 21, on how we should deal with that. God says, do not show partiality in judgment as far as how we deal with it legally. Loving our neighbor as ourselves. Okay, let's protect them with the same laws protect us. So I would just encourage pastors, don't take my word for it. Take God's word for it and go actually study this issue and see what God has to say about it, and then get up in the pulpit and talk about it and tell people about it, because the sheep are lost without a shepherd, and we need shepherds that are willing to labor in the word and in prayer. That's what elders, pastors are supposed to be doing, and then bring that and feed the sheep and equip them for the work of ministry. And I think that's what the church has to be doing.
Yeah, good word. I hadn't thought about that with the seed language. I often bring up John the Baptist and leaping the Holy Spirit and dwelling him even before birth. But here's another question for you. This sounds like this is a very specific question for a real scenario. William Boone, if couples in your small group were promoting IVF and the leader won't address it when they ask for prayer, would you break fellowship or go over the leader's head and bring it up anyway? I think what he's asking is, would you challenge that essentially? And he doesn't really give any
right.
I don't know if it's just promoting IVF with cautions or anything, but you take that any direction you want.
Yeah, I mean, always there's so many dynamics. It's hard to, as a lawyer, I'm always like, I can't give you specific legal advice because I don't know all the details of your situation. But obviously, as Christians, we should be very slow to break fellowship with people. Labor with them through this issue. Try to talk with people. Make appeals. With humility. But I think we have to talk about it. We have to talk about what goes on with IVF and educate people about that. Warn them about that. And we can ask our leaders in our churches to be doing that. But if they're not, we can and should go directly to the brothers and sisters that we have and warn them about that. I remember years ago, and this is opening up a whole other issue if we're not already controversial enough, but I read a book by Randy Alcorn called Does the Birth Control Pill Cause Abortions? And it was before I was married, and a friend of mine had asked me, like, oh, how many children do you want? And I said, like, oh, five or six,
Well, I'm not sure what happened there. I'm hoping that people can still see me. It looks like our friend Bradley Pierce is frozen. So let me know if you're streaming. Yeah, he froze. Okay, so you're still seeing me. Let me let me remove him from the stage, and I'm going to message him and ask him to rejoin. Can you rejoin? I was really looking forward to this too. That was a really bad time for him to go. We can see you, John. Okay. Well, I'm glad you could see me. Man, what a bad time for him to go. All right. Well, hopefully he'll come. Oh, here he is. All right.
Sorry about that. I don't know.
No, that's all right. I was worried that it was on my end. I'm glad it's not. So it was a terrible time for it to freeze. You're telling us the story, and it was like,
yeah,
the good parts. So let you continue.
Yeah. So anyway, I read this book, and I was like, wow, that's unbelievable. And I had, you know, a number of friends, you know, who are married that I didn't know whether they used the birth control pill or not, but I had, you know, I thought, you know what, I need to let them know about this. And I actually like bought 10 copies of the book and sent it to them. Mm-hmm. You know, most of them, you know, didn't really talk to me about it. But some of them were very, very grateful. And anyways, getting back to the issue here, I think that we have a duty to warn people. And ultimately, you know, after that, it's between them and God, but we have a duty to warn people. And so, I think that's what this person, you know, should do in a humble way and kind of working, you know, again, I don't know all the details, but working through channels as much as possible.
You know, as a seminarian, I remember in class, we had an ethics class, hearing the professor talk about IVF. And I remember thinking to myself, maybe this is to my shame, but and I think a lot of other people thought, well, I don't really need to pay attention too much to this because I don't think I'll ever have to go through any of that. And so, you know, this is a minority of couples. And the thing is, though, obviously, if you're a pastor, you have to counsel people who are going to have these questions. They're going to be in your office. And my experience has been most pastors know very little about IVF and the evils that can be attached to that process. And so counseling couples in that means first you need to understand exactly what it is, how it works, what are some of the dangers, what are the things to avoid if a couple goes that direction. Most pastors, I would wager, have almost no information about it. And they probably think it's okay. It's just, you know, kind of like getting surgery if you have a broken arm. It's just a medical procedure to overcome a deficiency. And so I think what you're saying is 100% right. We should we should probably encourage our pastors to look into this and be vocal. Let's see. There's some other questions here. And we have about 10 minutes. I try not to go too long after an hour generally. So just so you know, as we get into this, here's a question for you from Cappy Lover. I don't think that's the actual name there. It's a cat picture. So I don't think a cat's right again, but how can we get the organizations to do more to stop these ballot initiatives? I'm assuming these are the ballot initiatives or the constitutional protections of abortion. So very practical question.
Yeah. Again, I think it comes back to, we need to stop. When I say we, I mean the pro-life movement needs to stop acting like the work is done, right? Because whenever you're like, hey, we've saved all these babies and we were down to only, you know, five abortions in our state and Roe versus Wade is gone, and you're not actually talking about, but, right, all these babies are still dying and it's still legal for mothers, right? If you're only talking about the things that are sound really good, then you're actually putting people to sleep when you do that. And you're taking people out of the fight because you're telling them that the work's done, the fight's over. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think that's a big issue and one reason why the pro-life movement has lost many of these ballot initiatives and why, as you mentioned earlier, it seems like they have no plan in a lot of places. And I think it's because they really don't have a plan. I've actually even talked to some insiders that kind of say that there's not really a plan. You know, we overturned Roe and it's like, well, now what do we do? And whereas the pro-abortion side does have a clear plan and they're being consistent with that. And that's where we have to be consistent. They're consistent is that, you know, it's not a baby, but even if it is, mom's rights trump baby's rights. And so abortion on demand up till birth, taxpayer funded. You know, we don't have a consistent, you know, plan on or, you know, vision on our side. We say life begins at conception, but, you know, the pro-life movement doesn't actually act like it. And that's what we've got to start doing.
Here's a question. Basically, William Boone is asking if you are against birth control or you think it's wrong.
Do I think birth, you know, that's a long issue, but I think that one of the aspects of birth control, the actual pill that every Christian, every person should look into is what the effects of it are. And some of the effects of it are to prevent the sperm from meeting the egg. And so there's nothing abortifacient, you know, as far as that goes. But one of the effects of it is that after the sperm has met the egg and joined together and you have a new life with its own unique DNA growing on its own, is one of the purposes of it is to actually thin the lining of the uterine wall in order to prevent that child from implanting and getting access to, you know, nutrients and oxygen and the things that you need to, for life, and ultimately, you know, essentially starves and asphyxiates that baby to death. And people need to understand that. So I think that is wrong, and people need to look into that.
What effects, from Pacific again, what effects on our water supply result from so many in-home abortions being done? I don't know if you have that info.
Yeah, you know, I've seen some info from some pro-life organizations talking about that. And I think that it does have an effect on the water supply. It is, in some ways, you know, there's two things. One is like, guys, who cares about the water supply? They're murdering people over here. You know, let's deal with that, and then we can deal with the water supply. But, you know, again, there's actually some pro-life organizations. There's one of them in particular, Students for Life Action. I'll go ahead and mention that they have a bill that they're pushing around the country to actually require the abortionists, you know, who send these pills to women, actually send them a body bag, basically, in order to put the body in there and then get it disposed of as medical waste instead of flushing it down the toilet, flushing him or her down the toilet. Yes. And again, that's one of those, like, guys, the goal is not to make this more sanitary. You know, the goal is to abolish it. And, mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there is an effect on the water supply. But it makes me, it reminds me of the what God says about the shedding of innocent blood, that it pollutes the land, right? That's what God says happens when you shed innocent blood. It pollutes the land, and then that blood cries out to him for judgment. And if we don't provide justice, then he will to those who are committing it and to the people of the land, he says, that are allowing it. And so that's the pollution that we need to be worried about most.
Yeah, I did not know about that. Maybe the logic behind that would be they have to sort of have a mental pause if they're putting the child in a body bag and think about the fact that this is a human. I don't know. But you remember, it was a few years ago, not a few. It's probably more like a decade or two decades ago when there was a big push. I mean, there still kind of is, but there was a big push at one point to get these. Why am I blanking on the name? These machines that, you know, show you the ultrasound. Thank you. Ultrasound machines. Into as many communities as possible. Because the idea being, if a woman could see her child on the screen, and if you made that one of the things that she had to go through in order to receive help from a pro-life organization, like a CareNet or something, that she would choose life. And I don't know all the numbers on that. I mean, it makes sense to me that would be, you see your child up there on the screen, but it seems like the younger generations are becoming more aggressively pro-abortion, despite the technology clearly showing this is an actual child. The right. Information is out there in a clearer form than it has ever been. You can access that right away easily from your home, you know, mobile device. But it's the human hearts that are hardened.
Right.
And that's something that an ultrasound machine can't fix, you know, or a body bag or some of these other items, I suppose. But that's my own commentary. I don't know. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I mean, again, that's why we ultimately have to talk about this issue as sin, right? And that those who are committing it, the women who are committing it, the men who are, you know, pressuring them into it or facilitating it or involved in any way or just abdicating their role to, you know, to lead, you know, that they are culpable as sinners and it should be a crime. God says it's a crime. That's how we should treat it. And when we say, like a lot of the pro-life organizations have been, well, everyone is a victim, then, you know, that doesn't solve the issue, right? Christ came to save sinners. And so we have to admit our sin before we can receive, you know, the solution to that sin, which is, you know, salvation through Christ. But we have to get to that issue.
Yeah. All right. One question real quick for me: was freeing the Jews from Pharaoh not a political reality, John, from Jibberty Jabber? I think the intent behind that is maybe trying, it's not phrased maybe well, but I think the intent is to say that if God is behind the effort, then it will succeed, to which I say amen and yes. In our democratic process we have, which is not universal, not every country has the processes we have, it does take a certain amount of people to get policy done, at least in a legislative body. And so, so you can look at where votes are, where polling says people are, and you can see perhaps if God is working in people's consciences, and that's what we need to pray for. If that's the mechanism that he's going to use, then he's going to use it. But no, I do agree, God is ultimately in control. Bradley, one last question for you that I think we should end on here is really the reason I had you on. What can normal, average, everyday Christians, blue or red states, where should they be putting their resources and time if they care about this issue, which they should care about it? And where do you see maybe an encouraging glimmer of hope where we can maybe see a victory here in the near future?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm part of the abolitionist movement. I think that that's where Christians should get behind and support. I think it's consistent with what God says we should do, and not just what he says we should do, but how he says we should go about it. So I think that's where Christians should get behind and support. And we're seeing a lot of movement on that, a lot of progress being made. Yes, it's slow. We all want things to happen instantly. But that's not normally how God works. Sometimes, you know, abolishing evils this massive takes generations even. And so, but we need to be faithful, right? That's what we're called to be. And then we trust him with the results. And so I think that's where Christians need to get behind. We're seeing in the bills, we've been introducing bills since 2016. We're seeing those bills getting more co-authors, more legislators signing on to those bills than ever before. More of those bills being filed this year than any year before. Those bills getting further. We got to the committee to the floor vote in North Dakota this year, had more votes on the floor than we've ever gotten, more votes in committees that we're seeing than we've ever had before. And, you know, if you study history, it gives you hope. That's not original with me. I forget who originally said that, but you know, you look back at like William Wilberforce trying to abolish the slave trade and then trying to abolish slavery and starting off with very few votes in favor and then just kept reintroducing it. And slowly the votes, you know, began to climb. And yes, sometimes they dipped and then sometimes they came back, but eventually got the votes to do it. And I think that's what we have to do and be willing to do. We live in a very instant gratification, short-term thinking kind of society. And we have to get out of that and think biblically, think generationally, think, you know, more eternally in the way that we act. And when we do that, then we don't have, although I want it to end today, we can have patience knowing that as long as we're doing what we should do, sowing the seed, then we can trust God with the results and when that's going to happen.
Amen. Yeah, we have questions now coming in on the 14th Amendment and all kinds of things. But guys, it's been over an hour. So if you want Bradley to come back on the program sometime, then maybe we can do that. But I appreciate your time. And I know it's very valuable. I think I read online, how many kids do you have?
We're expecting number 12 right now, actually.
You have an arm or something? I mean, is there
these kids? I wish. Maybe someday. But no, right now we don't.
So you have a lot of possibility there, but you know, you certainly have your plate full. You're trying to do the right thing on this. So I would just ask people out there, hey, pray for Bradley, pray for everyone involved in this fight. It's not easy. And we are trusting the Lord that he's going to bless these efforts over the long haul. And if we don't even live to see them, we will we will gain his well done and thou good and faithful servant as we go to heaven. So with that, thank you so much. God bless. And we'll talk later.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.